All right. Our next speaker is Tammy Swanson, and she comes to us from the Lawrence Berkeley National Lab. The title of her talk is Deciphering Metabolic Food Webs in Soils Using Novel Metabolomics Approaches.
All right, thank you guys for having me. I'm really excited to talk to you today about my involvement with the various projects using novel metabolomics approaches to look at carbon cycling in soils. Hopefully everyone's refreshed and ready to learn all about metabolomics. This diagram is probably pretty familiar to most of you, but it's just showing that as atmospheric carbon levels continue to rise, there's a redistribution of all this extra carbon into the various ecosystems. There's more going into the oceans. Is there a cursor? Okay. There's more going into the oceans and cycling there. There's more going through photosynthesis, which then goes into plant biomass, and also, of course, going into soil. Recently, we've surpassed 400 part per million atmospheric carbon dioxide levels, and we need to be below 350 part per million, which is considered the safe level. While there are many sustainable energy efforts focused on combating climate change, all of these efforts are really only going to decrease the rate of carbon dioxide accumulation in the atmosphere. But what are we going to do with all this extra carbon? It needs to go somewhere, right? Putting it into the ocean, unfortunately, will result in acidification. So can it go back into the ground? Can soil microbes take this extra carbon and somehow sequester it? So in order to begin thinking of ways that we can manage soil carbon, we need to understand the linkage between microbial communities in soil and soil organic matter. So we want to understand how microbial communities are shaped by the composition of soil organic matter, and then the other way around. How do microbial communities shape their surrounding soil organic matter? And there's been a lot of recent sequence seed efforts to figure out who is present in soils, but metabolomics, which tells us what is there, is really lagging behind. So we want to use metabolomics to look at what microbes like to eat and release into the environment. So to do that, we need to think of microbial communities as dispersed metabolic networks. So even small changes in microbial communities can have a large impact on how carbon is stored in soils. So with any other scientific question, we have lots of challenges. The first is that soil organic matter composition is very complex. And until recently, most efforts have really focused on categorizing soil organic matter into different groups of compounds, such as amino acids, carbohydrates, fatty acids, and so on. But we really need to understand the specific chemical composition so that we can link it back to specific microbes and their biochemical function. Second, microbes are typically treated as generalists, meaning that they basically will eat whatever they're given. However, our studies, as well as many others, have found that they are very specific. They're specialists, so they eat specific substrates. But we can really only understand that using higher resolution methods such as mass spectrometry, where we can track specific molecules as they're consumed and then released by certain microbes. And then finally, there are many abiotic properties of soil that can actually have an impact on carbon cycling, such as mineral content, by controlling the access of microbes to soil organic matter. So to begin understanding some of these questions, we're using biological soil crust, or biocrust, which are basically a network of microbial communities that exist in the top millimeter or so of soils and arid environments that can account for up to 40% of Earth's terrestrial surface. And one great property of biocrust is that it can actually secrete this EPS, which binds sand particles and stabilize the sand, preventing erosion. Desertification and resulting dust storms is a huge problem all across the world, especially in the western United States, as well as China near the Gobi Desert. The picture on the right is actually showing a huge dust storm descending on a village in China, and that was just one of many dust storms that occurred in 2010. Luckily, there are many efforts underway to control these types of problems. In China, for example, they're growing cyanobacteria, which is the primary producer of biocrust, in ponds, and then they're bringing all of this in via water tanks and then just spraying it all over the sand dunes. And then just in a couple of weeks, it starts colonizing and then binding the sand particles and then basically preventing erosion and dust storms. And then ultimately, it'll form biocrust. Another great property of biocrust is that it exists in this desiccated dormant state in the field. So we get our samples from Moab, Utah, which is near Colorado. And we can take those desiccated samples, collect them in little petri dishes, bring them back to the lab where they can be stored in that state for many years. And then once we're ready for experiments, for example, we can add water, which simulates a wet-up event, and then monitor the cascade of metabolic activity as the microbes wake up and become metabolically active. And here's a little example of that. This is a dry sample, and when water is added, you can actually see the primary producer. In our case, it's Microcholis vaginatus. It becomes metabolically active, it turns green and starts moving up to the surface, and you can see the CO2 bubbles starting to come up. So our technical approach in the lab that we rely heavily on is untargeted liquid chromatography mass spectrometry, or LCMS. And for this, we take our sample, we generally extract it, or we take the pore water from crust or spent media from cultures. It's then dried down and then resuspended for liquid chromatography. So the first step, the liquid chromatography, will separate the analytes based on their hydrophobicity. In our case, we're using normal phase chromatography. The compounds then go into the mass spectrometer. Sorry about the typo. It then fragments the compounds, and then you can detect them. So we look at all the fragments and the retention time, and then we can take those specific metabolites and then compare them across all treatments or samples. So to look at metabolite exchange or consumption or competition in biocrust, we're using what's called exometabolomics. And this is an approach where we're looking at the consumption and release of specific metabolites by LCMS of bacterial isolates. So this will tell us if bacteria are generalists, again, so will they eat whatever they're given, or are they specialists where they prefer certain substrates over others, and then again, to what degree are they competitive in a given environment. So for these experiments, our first step was to select representative isolates from the biological soil crust, which is a very daunting task because you have thousands of microbes. So we wanted to have microbes that were diverse but abundant in our samples. So for these experiments, we chose 7 isolates. One was Microcholis vaginatus, again, the primary producer. It's a filamentous cyanobacteria that's a phototroph. And then the other 6 isolates we selected were heterotrophs. Next, we perform exometabolomics, and since soil organic matter consists largely of lysed microbes, we made rich media consisting of lysates from either Microcholis or of lysates from the other 6 bacterial isolates. We then took each isolate and then grew it in the rich media. And then we took the spent media from those cultures, and then using LCMS, we compared it to uninoculated controls. So the idea is that if you see a decrease of a peak or a metabolite, the assumption is that it was consumed by that isolate, whereas if you see an increase in a peak or the presence of a new metabolite, the assumption is that it was released by that isolate into the spent media. Next, we take all the data, and then we can start to assemble putative microbial food webs based on what the different isolates like to eat and release into the environment. So first we looked at Microcholis because we know that this bacteria plays a large role in biocrust community dynamics. And on the figure on the lower left, you can see these are all metabolites we detected in the cell extract of Microcholis. And each metabolite is indicated by a very narrow vertical bar. And you can compare that to all the metabolites we detected in the spent media. And what was interesting is that we saw a large fraction of intracellular metabolites were released into the media. And we think that's a way of possibly supporting microbial diversity or feeding close microbes that may have complementary functions. So next we compiled all those data with the data of the other isolates, and you can see it becomes a bit more complex. We detected over 400 metabolites, and then we compared the levels of those metabolites in the spent media of all the isolates, shown by colored bars up here, to the control, again, the uninoculated cultures. And for example, you can see glutamate, compared to the control, was consumed by all the isolates that we tested. So that indicates potential competition for this metabolite. On the other hand, metabolites such as adenosine were released by some isolates, such as microcoleus and bosea, whereas they're consumed by other isolates. So that indicates that there's potential exchange of adenosine and other metabolites that were similar to this. So next, we compiled all that data and put together this complex microbial food web by comparing all the metabolites indicated down the center by tiny dots, and their uptake, shown in red, and their release into the media, shown in green, by all of the isolates. And you can see right away there's three main categories of substrate utilization. There's competition, exchange, and then those that are released into the media and not consumed by any isolates. So for example, if you focus on bosea, first you see some degree of competition. So it consumes some metabolites that other isolates also consume. There were a large fraction of metabolites released from bosea and all the other isolates that were just hanging out in the spent media and not consumed by any isolates. And then finally, we found a large degree of metabolite specialization, or a very small overlap in metabolite utilization, where, for example, bosea consumes metabolites that are released by others, or releases metabolites that are consumed by others. And then this is another way to look at the overlap in metabolite utilization with all the data. And the numbers around the pie chart indicate the number of isolates that consumed a given fraction of all the metabolites we identified. And again, you can see that there's a very small overlap in metabolite utilization, where about 25% of the metabolites we detected were only consumed by one isolate, and only two metabolites were consumed by all seven isolates. And then again, a large fraction, about 40%, were not consumed by any of the isolates that we examined. So in summary, for just this portion of the talk, we found a fairly large degree of metabolite specialization with these bacterial isolates from the BioCrest community. And we think this is basically a way to avoid eating each other's lunch and avoiding competition in the BioCrest environment. And again, like I said, it could be a way of supporting microbial diversity since there's very little competition. So next, we wondered about the abiotic components of soil that may impact the accessibility of soil organic matter to microbes. So we looked at mineral content. And in this case, we used a very similar approach where we took a soil microbe, we used a pseudomonad here, we grew it up, and then we lysed it, and then added this lysate to an iron oxide mineral. For these studies, we use ferrohydrite because it's got a very large surface area. So if we see sorption, it's likely to occur with this mineral. And it's found in a lot of different environments. So we took that mixture and incubated it for 24 hours. After that point, we took the spent media, or the supernatant, and ran it on LC-MS to look at which metabolites sorbed to the mineral surface. So using our LC-MS approach I showed you earlier, we detected about 50 compounds from that pseudomonad lysate that we tracked for sorption with increasing mineral concentration. And what we found is that the phosphate-containing compounds, such as some sugar phosphates, cofactors, and nucleotides, were the most sorptive. And for all cases of sorption, it increased with mineral concentration, which was not too surprising. And then the second best group of compounds were the dicarboxylates, such as aspartate and citromalate. So if we compare these data to the exometabolomics data, these are all metabolites that we found were consumed by at least one isolate in the previous experiments. So even though they're consumed in culture, you can imagine that in iron oxide-rich environments, such as like ferrohydrite environments, they may not be available for microbial consumption, especially ones that are the most sorptive, like in the dicarboxylate category. So finally, I talked a little bit about, we found 40% of the metabolites in the exometabolomics experiment were not at all consumed by the isolates we detected or we analyzed. So why are microbes going through all the trouble of producing these when they're just going to release them into the environment? One big possibility is that there are other isolates that we did not look at that are consuming them, and this is an ongoing area of research in our lab. And then another possibility is that they're being released into the environment so that they can get access to limiting nutrients such as iron or phosphate. And this is really interesting to me because most studies have looked at microbial production of organic acids to get access to iron or phosphate. So I wanted to determine if there are other metabolites that maybe microbes produce to get access to phosphate. So to examine this, we took the same mineral, ferrohydrite, and then we loaded it up with phosphate. So it was in a phosphate buffer for 24 hours. And then after that time point, we found that up to 75% of the added phosphate was absorbed to the mineral surface. We then removed the unbound phosphate and then added in metabolite and then monitored phosphate desorption up to 24 hours. So for this experiment, I only took a subset of metabolites to examine, and I looked at the most sorptive compounds. And what I found is that the phosphates, which again were the most sorptive, also desorbed the most phosphate, sometimes reaching up to 30% phosphate desorption by 24 hours. And then there were some non-phosphates, such as citrate and glutathione, that did desorb a small amount of phosphate. So even though, like I said, we only tested a small amount of metabolites here, I hope to expand this because it does seem that microbes may be producing some compounds that are acting as siderophores and therefore getting access to limiting nutrients, in this case, phosphate. So in conclusion, I found that the primary producer of biocrust, which in our case is Microcolis vaginatus, releases a very large fraction of its intracellular metabolites, and as I mentioned, that could be a way of supporting microbial diversity and feeding its friends that may provide benefits to it. We also found, interestingly, that the soil bacteria that we studied show a high degree of substrate specialization and niche partitioning, suggesting that there may be very complex microbial food webs in biocrust. So there's potential for exchange, and then there's a small amount of competition for substrates. And I also showed you that sorption in mineral surfaces, especially iron oxide such as ferrohydrite, could present a large component of resource competition, especially in soils. And then finally, I showed you that released metabolites such as phosphate-containing compounds, citrate, glutathione, could allow soil bacteria to get access to limiting nutrients. So in order to understand how soil organic matter is going to change with climate change, we really need to take into account many types of measurements, such as soil physical properties, such as mineral content, metagenomics, and metabolomics. Exometabolomics in particular is a great approach that may allow us to predict how soil organic matter will be present given a certain microbial community composition. And then the other way around, if we know how soil organic matter will be in a certain environment, we can maybe predict how the microbial community will change. And then you can look far into the future, and maybe sometime we'll be able to bioengineer microbes that take the carbon out of the soil and then produce yucky compounds that are not consumed or mineralized by other microbes, but they're sequestered by minerals. So with that, I'd like to thank my PI, Trent Northern, who couldn't be here this year, unfortunately. A lot of this work, especially the exometabolomics, was done by Richard Buran. And then I got a lot of either computational or experimental assistance from Rebecca, Susie, Ben, and Ulash. And then Owen and Farhan are both collaborators on the biological soil crust projects. And then Peter Nico at Albionel, he worked on a lot of the mineral sorption experiments with me. And I'm not a soil scientist by training, so I've been learning a lot from the great soil science labs at UC Berkeley, Mary Firestone's lab, as well as Jill Banfield, and then funding from the DOE. And then if anyone has any questions, feel free to email me or check out our website.
What was?
You have some metabolic.
Yeah.
They're metabolites like amino acids and sugars, so I don't think they would have a detrimental effect on microbes. We're not really looking at antibiotics or anything with our experiments. We're looking at more of the water-soluble, smaller compounds. So they're central metabolites. I don't think they're toxic or anything. I think the biggest possibility is that there are other isolates that we haven't examined, because we only looked at 7 out of the 1,000. So I'm sure there are many others that we're looking into. Yeah. So it was two separate experiments. The first one, I can go back to it. So the first one, we're looking at metabolite sorption onto the mineral surface, so no phosphate. So we're just adding the metabolites to the mineral and then looking at which one sorbed after 24 hours. Yeah, so the second one, we bound the phosphate to the mineral surface, and then we removed what didn't bind, and then added each metabolite individually, and then just monitored phosphate desorption. Yeah. Get phosphorus. Yeah. Yeah, I know, I was a little disappointed when I thought, oh, the phosphates, you sort the most phosphate, that's not terribly exciting. We tried looking at like the mole-to-mole ratio, that maybe a small amount of this metabolite is being released to somehow get access to large amounts of phosphate, and the experiment didn't quite work out. But you're right, it wouldn't make sense. That's why we're starting to focus more on the non-phosphate compounds, which would be a bit more interesting. But it's hard to say without knowing the exact concentrations of the phosphate and phosphate metabolites. Yeah. This is only the first step of examining it. Yeah, and that's something I wanted to talk about, and I guess it could have fitted in. So the primary producer secretes an exopolymeric substance that you can actually see microbes within it, so they're trapped in there. And we're starting to do some sequencing to see who's there, and then we're going to narrow in on those bacteria to see the metabolite exchange. And more than likely, it includes isolates that we did not test. Because, I mean, they're physically associated with the primary producer, and they're definitely going to be exchanging metabolites, especially because microcolase does not fix nitrogen, so it's got to get it from somewhere. Yeah. Yeah. That's a good question. I hadn't planned that, but it would be a really good idea. And we were trying to look at the overlap of the different metabolites we detected with the different experiments. And right now they don't overlap quite as well because they're different, very independent experiments, but it would be a good idea to look at BioCrust and, and looking at the specific mineral content of the BioCrust and how that can impact. Yeah, that's a great idea. mostly because the crusts are stored for quite a while, and we assume that most of them have volatilized. And we're using LCMS. Definitely. Okay, that's a great idea.